You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Frank Mink was only 14 years old in 1989 when he shaved his head, put on a pair of red lace Doc Marten boots, and joined a neo-Nazi skinhead crew. In the years that followed, he became one of the most violent racist skinheads in America. But after he was released from prison, he had a gradual change of heart, and today he is a sought-after anti-racism advocate who worked closely with Harmony Through Hockey, a program he founded to teach racial tolerance to teenagers. He tells his story with the help of Jody M. Roy in a book called Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. It's published by Hawthorne Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Frank Mink to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thank you for having me.
From the way that you've described it, it sounds like being a skinhead is something that you more or less fell into as a teenager. Do you think that you might have joined an entirely different group, like the Hare Krishnas, for example, if they were the ones who'd approached you?
Oh, absolutely. I was just a shooken up soda bottle waiting for someone to open up the top and spray me in whatever direction. I mean, I could have been a left wing guy in Colombia right now, a gorilla up in the hills. You know, who knows? I was just a pretty broken human being by that time.
Because of the problems at home, your parents?
And problems at home.
Were you looking for family?
I at 14, you don't know that you're looking for this, but it was happening. I like to say that when I first started hanging with the skinheads and they would start talking to me about life and talking to me about growing up in Philly because these kids were out from the Lancaster area. I like when they ask me about school. I like when they ask me about growing up because my parents never asked me, how was school today? It's not a sob story. It is what it is. My parents never asked me those questions.
Well, Lancaster, isn't that where the Amish live?
It's all Amish.
So there aren't Amish skinheads.
No, no.
Do they tolerate each other?
I don't even think the Amish even know what they are. You know, I mean, there's like normal, and I don't mean to put down the Amish by not saying they're normal, but there's normal people that live in that community, and it's mostly all white, and so that's where a lot of some of the skinhead kids were coming from.
So how did you meet them? Who introduced you to the skinheads in Lancaster?
My cousin was one, and my cousin grew up he originally grew up in South Philly, and then his family moved him out there, and I would go out to visit him a lot because they liked bringing family up for him because now he lived up in the farms. So I would go up and visit him a lot, and he was a skateboarder, punk rocker. I was a wannabe skateboarder and punk rocker, and so I always kind of looked up to him.
And you decided to shave your head after an experience with your new skinhead friends in a mosh pit.
Yeah.
That was a family thing again.
It kind of was. When we started the club, when we got there, there was all these fights with the skinheads fighting all these other people. And this bigger skinhead put me on his shoulders and said, come on, because I still had hair. So the skinheads might accidentally beat me up because they didn't know me yet. Not all of them anyway. And so we go into the mosh pit and get into a fight and we got kicked out. And everyone kind of feared him. And I loved that. I loved people fearing me now. For so long, I feared going home. I feared going to school. You know, and now I'm on the other end of it, and I love that feeling.
Was it easy to find other skinheads when you returned to South Philly at the end of the summer?
It kind of was. I mean, it was an easy way to grow up is that we grew up in neighborhoods, little sections, little Irish sections, little Italian sections, little black sections. So we're kind of segregated, but it's also diverse. But so it was easy to teach the kids, like, hey, we don't go in their neighborhoods. You know, why don't you stand more for this?
Well, I can't imagine that if I just wanted to find skinheads in New York, I would just go to some neighborhood.
And that's not what I had to do. Well, here's the good thing for me.
There was a skinhead alley.
Yeah, but that's right off the punk rock streets in Philadelphia. So there's kind of this punk rock scene there. So it wasn't like right in the heart of my neighborhood was punk rock alley. That was out in South Street, which is known for being a punk rock alternative section of town. But what happened was I went to high school that year, the first year I was a skinhead, and they couldn't deal with me. They didn't, and I was a wild kid. I mean, I talked about my beliefs nonstop by that time. I mean, that's all I can talk about. So what they did is they kicked me out of high school and sent me back to my old elementary school to do eighth grade over again because they couldn't control me. So I went there, and now I'm the toughest, oldest white kid in my school. So I'm recruiting all the other tough white kids out of my school to be part of this thing with me.
And you went to this place called Skinhead Alley where you drank together and planned attacks and celebrated Hitler's birthday on April 20th?
Mm-hmm. That was a big day for the movement and a big day for us to reason to party.
What was happening with your family? Because you were sleeping in Skinhead Alley sometimes.
I would sleep, homeless. I can't I put that in the book as just saying that I was a homeless kid in downtown Philly, but a lot of times I would sleep over other skinheads' house. With my family, I mean, I was kind of a mistake and always knew that. My mom has gotten remarried. My dad had gotten remarried. They both had these new lives, and I was just this kid that came out of a drug-fueled drinking relationship. And so I got to do whatever I wanted.
And probably led you to your own drug and drinking problems.
Absolutely. I was bred to be an alcoholic.
The skinheads you associated with seem to have two main enemies or targets, the Zogs and the Sharps. What do those acronyms stand for?
Well, Zog stands for Zionist Occupational Government, and that is this. They believe the secret organization that secretly runs the world and secretly runs the United States, and it's mainly like an Israeli secret group kind of that they believe the Jews secretly run everything, and from the Federal Reserve to the media to you name it, they run it.
Did you know Jews in Philadelphia?
No. There's none of my near, none of my section, no.
So any Jews could be anything.
Yeah.
And what about the Sharps?
Sharps are a group. They're also skinheads, and they're anti-racist skinheads. And they've been around just as long as the neo-Nazi skinheads. You just don't ever hear about them because the media doesn't give them any play. And this Sharp stands for Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. And they're kind of like the left-wing group of the skinheads.
And you believe that you were actually doing God's work, didn't you?
Oh.
There are Bible passages that many skinheads believe instruct them to fight or to kill certain people.
Oh, absolutely. That was our – and that's not all the white racist skinheads, but there's factions of each religion and different religions in the skinhead movement, and I happen to belong to the Christian identity one, which, yeah, we go up to Bible studies and be taught that we now have the right to put God's wrath on the world.
Well, can you cite a passage that would suggest that?
Well, you have to read between the lines, they'll tell you. Now, just so you know, I was born and raised very Irish Catholic. So I would go up to these Bible studies, and they would break out the Bible, and they would go through the first story of Adam and Eve. And they would say that the serpent that comes up to Eve to trick her to have this fruit wasn't really a piece of fruit. It was a serpent man who comes up and tricks her to have the forbidden fruit. He gets to have sex with her, and he impregnates her with Cain. And Cain later on kills Abel, and they say Cain starts the evil Jewish race. Now, if you ever, for whatever reason, look on one of these groups' websites, you'll always see they always say the same thing, that Jews are the seed of Satan or the son of Satan, and that all comes from that passage in the Bible. So being born and raised Irish Catholic, I remember thinking, I never learned this at Catholic school. I went to Mass on Christmas and Easter, you know. I never learned this stuff from Sister Mary Agnes or Father Wassel, and they told me that God is revealing the truth to you now. Accept it. You know,
this is Christian identity, yeah. Which I also associate with the Aryan Nations.
Yeah, that's that used to be the main church up in Hayden Lake, Idaho.
So did you connect to the Aryan Nations, or did you try to connect to the KKK, which also have similar ideas?
Yeah, at first I went with the KKK as a kid. I was a young recruit into this invisible empire, and that didn't last too long. They kind of kicked us out because there were so many skinheads at the time joining, and there was a lot of violence, and the Klan kicked us out. They said that we give them a bad name, so they got rid of us. But then they didn't want to lose our numbers altogether, so we made up our own little affiliate group that kind of ran alongside their group. Later on, the movement I got so deep into kind of rejects the Klan altogether because they're just, you know, they think of these old guys. And so, but I always kind of hung around the Aryan Nations beliefs and with their groups.
How many different white supremacist groups are there? Do you know?
I mean, there's so many of them, and it goes this way. There's too many people with too many egos. So there'll be one group that always has big numbers, and then someone won't like someone, so they break off their own little faction. And that's every main racist group has started out that way, and then they all just break up. And you know, too many people want to be the Fuhrer today.
My guest is Frank Mink, who tells his story in autobiography of a recovering skinhead. On the cover of the book is a photo of you with a huge swastika tattoo on your neck. How old were you when you got that tattoo?
Probably 15, maybe 16, around that time.
And so, it's a rather ornate tattoo. I guess this is kind of an Aryan Nations version.
It was, it's kind of converted to a circular swastika, so it can have a Celtic cross in it. And, so it's not blazing swastika, but if you look at it long enough, you can tell what it is.
Because it is kind of ornate. And it has special meanings, or is it just a way of saying swastika without saying swastika?
No, it was a group called White Combat, which was just basically you had to be the head of one group to be in White Combat. It was kind of like a committee type thing, and you had to get the tattoo if you were in the group White Combat. So I never really considered myself much of a member of that group, but I was allowed to get the tattoo, I would say.
And you don't have that tattoo anymore.
No,
Was it painful to have it removed?
Yes.
More painful than having it?
Absolutely. Because you had to do it over and over again. The laser surgery was maybe 8 times, and you had to do it every month and a half. You would get the tattoo removed again and again. And you have to take good care of it. I mean, once they start to laser surgery it off, you really have to take care of it. And then the woman who took it off was a Jewish woman who lost her family, some of her family in the Holocaust, and who just said, I would love to help take that off. So
you also had the word skinhead tattooed across your knuckles.
Yeah. And
They've been removed as well at
yeah.
the same time?
Yeah. See, these things right here, when you're looking for work, when I get out of prison, these are not good people skills, right? So they weren't working very well for me anymore.
Well, I would have thought that those tattoos would have made you easy for the police to identify, especially after you were interviewed on a couple of national television programs.
No,
did you think about that?
No, I didn't think about it. But later on, when I was on the run from the police and from the tri-state area of Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania, I was on the run out in Indianapolis. And the reason why the cops always knew it was me that did things was the guy – I also had a tattoo on top of my head. It says Made in Philly. So when I did bad things, people would just go to the cops and say, yeah, this is what he looks like. And the cop, oh, Frankie, you're talking about.
You pretty much became the poster child of the skinhead movement on the East Coast.
And people would say that. And, you know, some people now say it's not true. But you know what? I was the one that was picked to do the TV shows. I was the one that was picked to do the radio interviews for the skinhead. So,
and you said that you left Philadelphia to go to Indianapolis. That's because the cops were looking for you in connection with several episodes of skinhead violence. Mm-hmm. Did they have good cause to be looking for you?
No, absolutely. I was a thug. I was an absolute negative on society thug. They had every right to be looking for me.
So the Aryan Nation sent you to a safe house in Indianapolis. Why Indianapolis?
That was just where the safe house was.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, was there an enclave there, or would it have been pretty much the same thing if you'd been in Indianapolis and sent to Philadelphia?
Yeah, it was just a place to go to get me out of the area because I was bringing heat onto some of our groups.
And then you made your way to Springfield, Illinois, and you've described creating a new skinhead crew there. What kinds of kids were easiest to recruit to the skinhead cause?
You know, it would start out at a high school where we would have one kid in the high school, and we'd have him give out flyers and cause a little you know, stir a little mess up. And then we would go there and hang out. And it sounds kind of creepy now because I'm 35. I say we hung out at a high school, but I was 17 years old, so I kind of fit right in except for the tattoos. And what we do is we start hanging out with the alternative kids, not that alternative kids like skaters and punk rockers are racist. Actually, a lot of them are not anti-racist. But these group of kids, they kind of hung out at this parking lot outside of school, and they kind of were picked on a little bit. So I remember these main kids threw a battery at them, like the jock kids one day, and I was there. So I went over to the jock kids, and these pretty big kids, big football players, and I went over to them and just said, hey, who threw it? Now, you got to know that time in my life, and if you read in the book, I mean, I'm homicidal or suicidal on any given day, whatever which way the pendulum goes. Well, I go over to all these jock kids, and I said, who threw it? And they wouldn't tell me. They were like, oh, I didn't throw it, John. You know, they're blaming it on each other.
But the other kids saw that you were fearless.
Yeah. And then I went back over to the skater kids and said, hey, these kids are never going to throw anything at you again. So then you start recruiting them, and I would look for certain kids as bright as I could be at 17, but I would not always recruit like the same kids. Like, I wouldn't always recruit smart kids because you don't want a gang full of nerds, you know? I don't want all just tough kids, because when you get in that realm of wanting to be tough kids, you come across these kids that, I'm crazy. They tell you they're crazy, but they always get beat up because they're not really crazy, because real crazy people don't know they're crazy. And then, like, the good-looking guys, like, I don't recruit them because I don't need any competition to hang out in this group. I'd always recruit kind of the same boys. And the best kids for me at the time, which benefited me the most, were boys that drive cars.
Did it become easier to recruit new members after you started a public access television show?
Yeah.
You called it The Reich.
The Reich, yeah. And you know who was our biggest supporter is local media, local newspapers. They love us.
Because they saw you as a story to tell.
Exactly.
And people might not have ever known that you were doing that public access TV show unless all the newspapers talked about it.
Talked about and gave me free commercials. They would put at the bottom of the article, if you want to know more about what Mr. Mink's doing, watch his television show at 4:30 on Wednesdays on Channel 56. I mean, they feed right into it. You know, it's the media. They love racism in the ghetto. You know,
my guest is Frank Mink, M-E-E-I-N-K, whose story is told in Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead with the help of Jody M. Roy. The book is published by Hawthorne, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Later on in the hour, I will take a look at a new documentary called Hands of Love about Kibera, the largest slum in Kenya. And in the next hour, we'll find out how modernity has changed religious life in India. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Frank Mink, who has written with the help of Jody M. Roy, Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. It's published by Hawthorne Books. So there you are with this public television show. And about that time, you and a friend kidnapped a young man you suspected of being a sharp and made a video recording the savage beating that you gave him. What, you wanted evidence of what you'd done?
Now, again, not thinking very well, and thank God I wasn't really. But I did that so we can show all of our new recruits kind of what we do. And
but you showed a lot of other people, too.
No. I just showed the recruits, but word got out real quick. I mean, there was, the kid that we kidnapped knew that we videotaped it. And when we released him, he told the police that there was a videotape. So,
and that's what landed you in prison.
Yeah. Well, you know, and other activities. I mean, I was not, trust me, it could be all about freedom of speech, but I was a huge troublemaker, and the police were looking to get me anyway, and rightfully so. I was not a positive in their society at the time. So.
Well, you had thought that you would actually kill that guy.
We were going to. We had talked about it, but I had a feeling right from the get-go we were not going to go through with the killing of him.
Didn't you run into him in a restaurant a couple of years ago while you were on a lecture tour?
Yeah, I ran into him.
What did you say?
Well, he was sitting at a bar, and I was trying to stay sober at the time, so I'm drinking O'Doul's, which isn't the smartest thing. And I'm drinking O'Doul's. It was St. Patrick's Day, and I'm in St. Louis, and I'm sitting, and I'm eating a sandwich, and I looked over, and I kept thinking, you know, you have that thing, like, it looks familiar, and then I put it together, and I walked over to him, and I said, hey, is your name such and such? And he said, yes, and I said, did you used to be a sharp skinhead? And he goes, yeah. And he kind of leaned away from me. And he was trying to check me out. And I said, hey, you ever been kidnapped? And he goes, oh, my God, how you doing? And he knew that I had changed. He seen me on MTV. He said, I knew you had changed. And, and first thing he said to me was, I'm sorry, I went to the cops. And I was like, no, I need to make the amends here. And I'm trying to make the amends. And I'm thinking, darn it, you beat me too. You know, I wanted to do this. And anyway, we had a conversation. We hung out for maybe about 6 hours and only brought it up maybe once or twice and just kind of wished each other well on our way.
Well, prisons, skinheads do very well. White supremacists sometimes control portions of prisons. Don't they? So what happened when you arrived?
When I arrived, I was the little celebrity. I was the skinhead with the TV show, and I knew much more of the literature than the Aryans in prison. See, now there's the Aryan Brotherhood, which I was not a member. I was a member of the Aryan Nations in there, but they run together, and we're two, like, little different cliques, but we have different gang chiefs and stuff. And but we were all kind of friends, and they knew that I was not just this I hate everybody racist. Like, I had these reasons for hating people, and, you know.
The Bible told you so.
Yeah, the Bible told me so. I could talk with the Muslims because the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and these guys never heard that type of stuff. When I talked about how the Muslims hate the Jews just as much as we do, we should be aligned with them. You know, they just thought they should hate them because they were black, you know. So I kind of had a little bit more literature than they did in my head, so.
Now, you didn't go to trial? You accepted a plea bargain?
Oh, I would have. If I went to trial, I would have been done. They had that videotape of me kidnapping the guy. It would have been. I took a plea bargain for 3 years, and I already,
so you got off lightly.
Oh, I did. I did. What saved me, in a way, is I tricked him to come to my house to kidnap him. I didn't go and remove him from his persons where he was. So it went from an aggravated kidnapping to an aggravated unlawful restraint. So.
You also would play basketball with blacks and Hispanics at prison.
Football and soccer sometimes.
Did that humanize them for you? I mean, how did they deal with you? You had a swastika on your neck.
You know, at first I think I didn't like it, but then they seen that I was good, and I'm a really good athlete, always have been. I played in the Philly leagues when I was a kid, and we played on this all Irish team that played a lot of the black teams, and even with that, I would lead the league sometimes in touchdowns. So I'm pretty good at sports. And when I went out to go play, these guys seen I knew how to play, and they liked my competitiveness, and they seen that I took a lot of crap for playing from the other black inmates on the other teams, but I kept on playing, and they gave me the nickname Steve Largent. It was the little white guy from Seattle, you know? That was my nickname in there from them. So, you know, they didn't, and the Aryans didn't mind either, because the Aryans didn't play much sports, but when they did, they kind of sucked because they were all like bikers, so they can fix your bike at two, but they don't know how to cradle football. So the Aryans always thought I was a wild kid, for one, with a lot of intelligence, and I was a celebrity to them, and I was showing the black kids up that a white guy can play with them, you know.
But you appreciated the warmth that the black inmates showed you when you got word that your girlfriend had given birth to your son during the time that you were locked up. You didn't get that kind of warmth from the white supremacist inmates.
No, and it goes to the fact that they were older guys. All the Aryans were older than me. So a lot of the things that the older inmates would do to the younger inmates would always remind you that your girlfriend is having an affair while you're in there. Like, joke. Yeah, we try to joke with you, but they would be very serious about it. And so I didn't like talking to them about my home life because they didn't give me the answers I wanted. So I noticed when I talked to G and Jello and so many other guys from Chicago and East St. Louis, some of the black kids that I played sports with, that they would talk to me about their girls, and we kind of always say to each other what we wanted to hear. I would always say, man, your girl's going to wait for you. And they say the same thing to me.
But this didn't turn you around. When you left prison, you were still a skinhead.
No, absolutely. I just thought I was just keeping my sanity. You know, it never dawned on me. There was not that burning bush moment, you know, not at first. So when I got released from prison, I was going to go back to, you know, running my skinhead crew and getting back into the movement. And I mean, even though I was still in the movement in there, but to be real about it and get back into the movement. And so, it didn't change me at first. You know, I'm bullheaded.
Now, you say that Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing had a major impact. Why that? I mean, you were a pretty violent guy. You could have done something similar, couldn't you?
Oh, I would have. I would have if I was in the movement. I looked up to people. Not like Timothy McVeigh, because he came along later, but there was people like Robert Matthews and different people in the order. And I mean, I looked up to these people. But when the Oklahoma City bombing had happened, I'd already been out of the movement and kind of hated the movement now. I kind of had this thing with the movement.
What turned you around?
Well, it started with, I noticed that when I would hang out with my skinhead friends again, I just wasn't being uplifted anymore. And there was other incidents. O.J. Simpson helped me change, actually. DNA. I learned about this DNA thing in his trial when he was in trouble. So that kind of changed me. But I still kept a hatred of Jews so I could still hang out with the movement. And I wasn't telling everyone in the movement, oh, blacks are equal now. But to keep with all my friends, I still was going to hate the Jews.
Had you met any Jews at this point?
That's why I still hate them, you know? And then finally, a guy gives me a job working at an antique show. And this guy was a Jewish guy. And he gave me a job, and I made tons of money, and at the end of the weekend, he paid me well, and I thought, you son of a gun. You know, you're supposed to not pay me. You're supposed to not do the right thing here by me. And then he gave me a full-time job working with him.
Can only wonder what would have happened if he hadn't been a nice guy. There are nice Jews and not nice Jews.
No, absolutely.
You might still be a skinhead.
Yeah, and that's where it's God. God put people in my life to prove me wrong.
But there's a big leap from all of this to getting in touch with the FBI. Why did you do that?
Well, it was sitting at home when the Oklahoma City bombing happened and figuring it out before anyone else, not anyone else, but I knew it was the movement probably the afternoon as it happened. Like, it just started coming to me. I was like, wow, this sounds really familiar. And I seen that picture of that fireman running down the street with that dead little girl. And I hadn't seen my daughter. And her head is kind of caved in and bloody, and she's dead. This little girl is dead. And that picture just kept killing me. So I went that Friday, that Monday, I went to the FBI because I needed to relieve myself of something. I don't know what. I mean, I can't psychoanalyze it now, but there was something inside me that I felt so evil, even though I was out of it.
Timothy McVeigh recorded tapes. There's a film in which he says, well, you know, should get over it. After all, this was all part of a war, and people die in a war.
Collateral damage.
My guest is Frank Mink. His autobiography of a recovering skinhead is published by Hawthorne. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So the FBI put you in touch with the Anti-Defamation League?
Yeah. It was kind of funny because when they mentioned ADL, I said, oh, you know, that's the rival of the racist movement. I mean, they hate the ADL. For one, it's mainly a Jewish group, and they track these groups. I mean, that's what the ADL does. They kind of, you know, as they always say, they expose them and put light on them.
I'd imagine that the ADL people were a little suspicious of you.
Oh, absolutely. They had to put a book out in 1993. So this is 95 now. In 93, they put a book out of the top rising skinheads. So this before I ever even started working with them. They put out this book, and it's about the top people in the movement, and I'm in the book twice. So, you know, they knew of me and had questions.
But they might have thought that this was also a coup.
They met me very secretly. Met me in a hotel lobby with bodyguards, and, you know, it was a funny situation, and we talked. And I think what I did that they were trying to see what I was going to do was I was very honest. When they asked me about certain incidents, I would say, yes, I was there, or no, I wasn't there. Like, they were trying to see if I was going to do one or two things. Go, yes, I'm the big bad skinhead, I did it all. Or was it going to be the other way and say, oh, I was just along for the ride, and I'm actually just always been a good guy, you know? And I didn't do either of those things. So that's how they kind of came to believe me, I guess, and know that something was different with me.
So you started speaking to young people about racial tolerance. And then you went further. You actually created a youth hockey program with the Philadelphia Flyers.
Yeah. I wanted to give kids the opportunity that I didn't have in playing hockey. I loved hockey. Grew up, that's my favorite sport. It's spiritual to me, almost, playing hockey.
But you were a good basketball and football player.
Yeah.
Why not one of those?
Because hockey is such a team-oriented sport. You can't really have a hockey team with one good showboater on it. Like, I think sometimes with basketball, you can have just that one great guy and still win and be productive. In hockey, you can't do that.
So you did something with the Philadelphia Flyers and then later with a farm team for the Anaheim Ducks. Mm-hmm. Are they succeeding?
The programs?
Yeah.
Well, the program is still going on in Philadelphia. And it goes on under Ed Snyder's foundation, who is the owner of the Flyers. He kind of just took my program and kept on going with it and made it his own, and he did a great job with it, and he does almost the same exact thing. But yeah, it's a huge success. Kids want to have fun. You know, it's not rocket science for me. You know, it's an easy program to apply in life. But, you know, what I do now is when I have kids in the program, I make them do tasks. And this is different than any of the other programs where I make them go home and do nice things for people and not tell anyone they did it. Only tell me, Coach Frank, or go home and tell everyone in their house why they love them, or go home the next week and ask everyone to please tell them why they love them. So they always have to give it away to get it, and I keep doing that with them all season long. Go to your school and tell your teacher, why is that your favorite teacher?
The skinhead movement doesn't get as much press now as it did during the 80s and 90s. Is it still active?
It's kind of active. It's a lot of that big chunk of skinheads that came out in the mid-90s have either died off, gone to prison, gotten out of it, or moved on to other groups, you know, more militia-style groups and but the skinhead stuff's still out there. It's a subculture that will probably always be around.
And have you run into any of your old skinhead buddies?
Not my old not the ones that are still into it. No, I've run into a lot of them that are out of it. But I still run into, I got Portland, I ran into a guy who was a skinhead who didn't have very nice words to say to me. And, you know, what am I going to do?
He didn't say I'm sorry the way the guy, the Sharp, did. You said that writing this book has been part of your effort to recover from nearly a lifetime of drug and alcohol addiction. How old were you when you started drinking and taking drugs?
When I started drinking, see, now I got to just clarify that when I was in the skinheads, there's no drugs allowed. When you're in the Christian identity movement, there's no drugs. So, but there's a lot of drinking. So I drank from 15 at least, I drank every day. That's just the way it was. But later, I got out of the skinheads and now I was able to do drugs. And I did drugs. I mean, I went Oxycontin, heroin. You know, and people will try and psychoanalyze it and say, well, you were just trying to dull the pain. No, I like to get high. That's what I would.
Well, you also grew up, as you said, in a family where both of your parents took drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And the final section of your book, where you describe trying to beat the addiction, is touching but also troubling. You even managed to take drugs and fool everyone when you were in a residential rehab program. And after many years of trying to get clean, you seem to be on the verge of success. You started to shoot heroin.
Mm-hmm.
So have you been able to get past it now?
I have 3 years. I had 3 years.
How did you finally start?
June 7th. 12-step program. Really a real 12-step program and really working it and doing what other people told me to do to stay clean and sober and stop trying to do this thing myself.
And is that the advice you'd give other people?
Oh, absolutely.
With that kind of addiction?
I don't know. I've tried every solution out there. Anything besides having to go to meetings and talk to another human being about my feelings and trying to stay clean and sober, I tried every other way and it never worked.
Just one more thing before you go. I'm sure you've thought a lot about this. Why do people hate other people, especially people that they have had no contact with? Is it satisfying some special emotional need?
Yeah. I mean, it starts off that way. It starts off with identifying, giving yourself an identification. And then there's other things that go in, and it's the same thing with people that are thugs and people that are racist. There's two components in your brain, your ego and your fear, and they're combined to make that. And if you trouble my ego or trouble my fear, I lash out. And, you know, for whatever it might be, it gives you some type of purpose. And it's a mental illness in a way that you believe what you believe is right. Even though, I mean, really, it's the most evil thought is to hate another human being just because of the way God made them. But your brain tells you it's okay. We go back to the part where people that are crazy don't know they're crazy. So these people truly believe that they're right. Even though, I mean, if you look in the heart of your heart and heart and you read your spiritual in any way, you know that you cannot hate anything that you have control over.
A couple of listeners have written in to ask what you think about the movie American History X.
I think it's a good movie. It's a good portrayal of skinheads, and we talk about it in the book. So,
the book that we're talking about is Autobiography of a Recovering Skinhead. Still recovering, you think?
Not from the skinhead. I'm recovering from drugs and alcohol. The recovering skinhead part is kind of a trick. It's, you know, because that would sound like you can relapse. And it is, again, it's mentally, physically, and spiritually impossible for me to hate someone just because they're colored or skin. It's just impossible. So the recovery part is more on the drugs, and the skinhead thing is so long ago. I mean, I got out of it in 94, you know, so 94, 95, and you know, it's never tempted me to come
15
back.
15 years. It's a long
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
Frank Mink has told his story to Jody M. Roy. It's published by Hawthorne, and Mink is spelled M-E-E-I-N-K. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Up next, David Ware and Justice Unger discuss their new documentary, Hands of Love, about what life is like in Kibera, the largest slum in Kenya. It's part of the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. We'll also be joined by the coordinator of the organization's Youth Producing Change Program. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.